If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962. The Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King, within 24 hours, he would be dead, assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April 4th, 1968. Today is the federal holiday that honors him. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdulkaduz, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Peter Curries, and Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, Nick Gilla, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chamblee, Vesta Godars. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. Coming up next is More Talk Radio with guest host Marianne Borsarnik. Marianne will interview author and activist Ra Patel about his new book, The Value of Nothing.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Some people are asking if the recent airliner bombing attempt was a false flag operation. On Thursday, January 21st, my guests will be Wayne Madsen, an author and investigator, and we will explore that question. That's Fight the Empire, Thursday at 9:30 a.m. on KABU, your radio station.
Can you have both a market economy and a democracy? If we had to pay the entire cost of the ecological and social damage done by a hamburger, what would it really cost? Can you imagine a society where people, not markets, determine what something is worth? Author Raj Patel examines those questions in his new book, The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Join me, Marianne Barasonic, and author Raj Patel on Monday, January 18th at 8 a.m. for an hour of thought-provoking talk radio here on KBOO.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
It's called Masters of War. Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy.
Good morning and welcome to More Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barasonic and my guest today is Raj Patel. He's worked for the WTO and the World Bank, but he's also been tear gassed while protesting them. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, which looks at the world's food markets. His latest book is The Value of Nothing. Raj, thanks for talking with us. Raj, are you there?
Hello.
There we go. Great.
Hi.
So a lot of your work has been in the area of food, and one of the examples that you give is the true cost of a hamburger.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the way that we eat today is unsustainable in many ways. But that unsustainability is hidden from us in the price. And the example that seems to be capturing a lot of people's imagination is the idea of a hamburger. I mean, we may pay $4 for that hamburger. But some researchers in India a little while back said, well, all right, look, if that hamburger was grown on land that once upon a time used to be rainforest, in other words, if that rainforest was chopped down and pasture put in the place and cattle reared on that land, what would be the cost of the hamburger? And they did some sort of back of envelope calculations, looking at how what was lost when you lose a rainforest, looking at the carbon that's lost, the biodiversity, you know, the plants and the animals, and the services that rainforests provide to our ecosystem. And the value that they came up with was that a hamburger shouldn't cost about $4; it should cost nearer $200. And of course, that's just the environmental side of things. You know, the price of a hamburger doesn't include the pittance of labor wages that goes into making that hamburger, and it doesn't include the cost after we've eaten the hamburger. I mean, one in five healthcare dollars spent in the United States today is spent taking care of someone who has diabetes, and that is due in no small part to the way that we eat today being unsustainable. And of course, we don't pay the price for that when we buy the hamburger, but we do end up paying the price ultimately.
Okay, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. Well, one of the examples in your book that I thought was really fascinating, and I had no idea this was going on, of part of the cost that we don't pay in hamburger is the cost, the human cost of slavery in Florida. Can you talk about the cases that you had in the book?
Yes, and I mean, this is something that absolutely is hidden from us. I mean, we'd like to think that, I mean, particularly today, that slavery is a thing of the past. And tragically, since 1997, here in the United States, over 1,000 people have been freed from conditions of modern-day slavery. Now, you know, we might think slavery, you know, that just means that they've got particularly tough working conditions. But this isn't just having a bad boss. This is, you know, these are stories of people being locked up in the back of trailers and forced to work for a pittance, I mean, really pennies a day. And, you know, the workers who are picking tomatoes that end up in our hamburgers and our tacos and in our, you know, our big box stores, those workers are exposed to pesticides and they need to wash, but they're charged $5 for a shower. And, you know, when you're earning pennies a day, many workers have found that it's cheaper to wash your hands in bleach than to buy a shower from someone. And the 1,000 people who have been freed so far, they've been freed under the statutes that constituted abolition in the United States. So this really is modern-day slavery. And it's hidden from us in the way that we eat today. But, of course, and sadly, it is alive and well in southern Florida.
But part of that idea of slavery, there's also an economic slavery, because if people aren't making enough money to meet their basic needs, housing, food, medical care, education for their children, we don't call that slavery, but in a way that is economic slavery.
Well, it is. This is one of the ideas that I get to in the book. I mean, that free markets have kind of let us down. In fact, free markets aren't really free. There's an idea in the book about how it's a thought experiment that comes from an Oxford philosopher who says, look, if you think free markets are about freedom, imagine a world where instead of money, what we have, instead of markets, what we have is a world where people get given tickets at random. And those tickets would be have things on them like you have the freedom to cross the road. You have the freedom to get healthcare. You have the freedom to buy a car. You have the freedom to eat a meal. Those freedoms are written on the tickets, and some people get more tickets than others. And so we would say, look, the people with more tickets have more freedoms. They don't have to do these things. They don't have to go across the road. They don't have to have a car. But if they want them, they can, because they have these little tickets on them. And so what this philosopher says is, well, actually, the world we live in today with the free market, it's just like that world with the tickets, except instead of tickets, we have money. And in the free market, the more money you have, the more freedom you have. And so if you have a lot of money, you can have a car and have healthcare and you can go wherever you like. But if you are poor in the free market, then freedom is just another word for nothing that you can afford.
Right. And we have a caller. Good morning, caller.
Good morning. I understand your guest wrote a book called The Value of Nothing.
Yes.
And I would like to ask him a question about that.
Okay, go for it.
Sir, do you have nothing?
No, I, I've, I do not have nothing. I have accumulated possessions that I get from living in the world that I live in today. But the reason I wrote the book is that the way these possessions were gotten and the trajectory that accumulating all these things that we're heading on is one that's unsustainable not only for me and my family, but also for the world we live in. And I think we need to start making decisions about what we have and the way we get them. Because so far, the way that our consumer society puts the right to make decisions about what we have and what we don't, not in our hands, but in the hands of people far more powerful than us.
And so the issue of having nothing is not an accurate approach.
No, I think maybe you might want to read the book because one of the things I talk about in the book is that everyone needs to have something, and unfortunately, the world we live in at the moment, a few people have a great deal, and because they have a great deal, many people have very little, and that inequality is something that is not accidental to the system that we have at the moment. What I would like is a world where everyone has enough to live and has enough to have health care, to have a decent education, and to have a planet that's worth living on. At the moment, we do not live in that world.
So then a more accurate title would be having someone else choose what you should have.
No. The argument in the book, and it's as I say, I stand by it. The world that we live in at the moment, other people are already choosing what we have and what we and what we can't have. And as I say, the free market is substantially unfree, precisely because there is no democracy in the free market. In fact, one of the arguments is that the free market and genuine democracy are incompatible.
So when I choose to go to work and earn a living, it's not my choice then.
No, when you choose to go to work and earn a living, we all, in fact, need to work. But when you choose when you're in a position of working to consume things that mean that other people in other parts of the world have to suffer and have to have very little choice about how it is that they live and work, then the system in which we work systematically takes away choices from people rather than puts them in their hands. And that's the illusion of consumerism. The idea of consumerism is that we are making choices. We are free. We can go into Walmart and pick whatever we like. But the trouble is that if we all worked at Walmart and if we all went into Walmart, we wouldn't be able to shop there because we're part of a system that underpays workers, that underpays us for the work that we do, so that we then have to pass on our low wages onto people who are much less fortunate than we are. And it keeps people trapped in conditions of poverty. And, of course, that's true in the United States, too. It's harder than ever before in the United States to, if you work really hard, to move up a class. And, we have this myth in the United States of if you just work hard, things will come your way. Well, that's not true if you look at the data. It is today harder than ever if you work incredibly hard, as we all do, to move up a class. And so that's one of the lies that's sold to us as part of the free market.
Okay.
And do you raise your own food or do you buy food at a store?
I think we're going to move on here. We've got another caller. Thank you for your questions, caller. Those were great. And we've got another caller. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. It's hard for me to talk about this because I've been seeing how my personhood and my little broken down family with all the dynamics of capitalism with its technologies, movies, TV, and that has, and I've been seeing this for a long time alone, not just with me, but with our culture. I just want to ask something, because it's more complicated than I'm going to put out. Do you believe that what helps keeps us slaves, I'm just going to mention a couple of things, in this country and distracted from the political reality of our lives, etc., is being hypnotized by using computers and looking at TV programs and the movie industry and the fast pace. I'll just leave alone and see what you have to say. Thank you.
So your question is, are we being hypnotized by the movie industry and computers?
Well, there is a way, in which we are certainly held in thrall by the images that we see on television are of lifestyles that are for the most part, almost utterly unattainable to working American families. And in fact, in the book, I talk about how there was a strange episode that happened in Bhutan, which is a small country in South Asia. But Bhutan most famous not for having a terribly good standard of living, but having a country that has, in various measures, the happiest population on earth. And one of the things that happened recently was that the king of Bhutan decided that it was time to have satellite television. And so all of a sudden, satellite television was beamed into this little kingdom that had been, in many ways, isolated from the rest of the world. And you know, in came these images that you and I are subjected to every day. You know, images of sort of people consuming things left, right, and center, and a way of living that is, in many ways, as I say, unattainable for us. But if it's unattainable for us, it's certainly unattainable for very, very poor people in South Asia. And it was very interesting. The reports of what happened were very striking. That young people, in particular, started stealing, and they went on a crime spree in order to be able to afford the things that all of a sudden to them seemed very natural. It seemed desirable. So things like cell phones, for example. And this is a story that I hear from around the world. That as soon as the images, as I say, the images of U.S. television come in, you have increases in crime. You have increases in the level of young people who quite reasonably aspire to consume things that they see on television, but have no way of making that happen because you know the systems that have you know the way that the international economy works. There's no way that someone, you know, a young person in Bhutan is ever going to be able to afford an iPhone. And so the images that we see on television that we're saturated with certainly make us desire things that are beyond our means. And I also talk about how the widening inequality in the United States, therefore, you know, these images that we're surrounded with, when the top 10% of the population are consuming more and more and more, and those images trickle down and we're surrounded by them, the net effect of that for the rest of us is to make us very unhappy, and this persistent inequality is something that we are surrounded by, we are saturated by, and it's something weirdly that even Adam Smith, the godfather of modern economics, understood. He understood that the reason we work in the economy, the reason we push things forward today, is not because we are satisfied and as soon as we have enough we stop, but because we want to keep up with our neighbors. And the way that we are shown to, the way we're encouraged to keep up with our neighbors today is through these images in Hollywood, in advertising, in billboards, in sort of consumer society. So I think, weirdly, there is something about the idea of being hypnotized by computers and by Hollywood. It's not in the way that we think. It's not a sort of man with a watch on a chain sort of dangling it in front of our eyes. It's far more insidious.
But the effect is the same. You're listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and my guest today is Raj Patel. We're talking about his book, The Value of Nothing. Good morning, caller.
Is that me?
Yes, it is you.
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Well, another day in paradise, ma'am.
All right.
Mr. Patel, I have admired your work for like quite a long time, and I really admire you. That being said, isn't a perfect example of what you're talking about the situation that we have in Haiti today? I understand that the minimum wage in Haiti is 38 cents an hour,
right.
Brought about by the neoliberal economic model. People were moved off their land and brought into the city so they can become a cheap labor pool. Virtually no government in Haiti. The reason that the buildings collapsed was because there's no building code in Haiti. Buildings just put together, slapped together willy-nilly, that just collapsed. Mm-hmm. And another example of that would be some of the schools in China, which collapsed during that horrible earthquake. Also fell apart because there was no building standards, and so can we talk about the neoliberal economic system and its impact on people? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, sadly, whenever Haiti appears on our screens, it is when something bad has happened there. Before this earthquake... Hello?
Oh, I think we lost him, but he was taking his answer off the air, so
okay.
Keep going.
what we saw a couple of years ago before this earthquake were food riots in Haiti. And in fact, one of the reasons why Port-au-Prince has so many people living in such dire conditions has everything to do with, I have to say, U.S. government policy. And that began in the 19—let's sort of go back in time. I mean, the government policy, the U.S. government policy in Haiti has been happening for a while. Woodrow Wilson occupied the country for 14 years. More recently, there's been a really sad transformation. I mean, at the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti grew the majority of its own rice. It was able to feed the majority of its population with homegrown rice. Unfortunately for Haiti, the Haitian people wanted a government that would invest in the development of the country, a left-wing government. This, for President Reagan, was unacceptable. There was no way that there was going to be a left-wing government on the doorstep of the United States. So Reagan negotiated what's called a structural adjustment package. And basically, it was a loan to Haiti, and so it seemed like a very generous thing that the president was doing. And it was done through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But attached to this loan were conditions about how the government should open up its markets to the free market, in particular, open up its rice markets to free markets. But in rice, there is no free market. Although Haitian rice farmers earn a pittance for their rice, they were able to make a living at it. But unfortunately, they had to compete against U.S. rice farmers. And U.S. rice farmers, according to the Cato Institute in some years, get $1 billion a year in public subsidy. So you have poor farmers on the one hand earning very little, and on the other hand, rice from the United States that's subsidized to the tune of $1 billion a year. So, of course, Haitian rice farmers first started to panic, and they exploited their environment to try and just make enough rice to survive. But there's no way they could compete. And so they left rural areas for the cities, where they were then used as a sweatshop labor. And that happened not only under Reagan, but under Clinton as well. And then, of course, there was a coup, which we're trying to find out the extent of U.S. involvement in that, though that I imagine is pretty deep. And now we have the situation that we have, where last year people were fighting over bags of rice that had on them the words, "gift of the people of the United States." This is the gift that keeps on taking, the gift of intervention and the gift of the free market that subjugates Haitians in the Haitian environment and the Haitian labor to the whims of this country.
Okay, and we're going to take another caller. Good morning.
Happy holiday, Marianne. Happy holiday, Raj Patel. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say you're so right on, and I believe the first listener caller may have misinterpreted, but exploitation always does lead to this deprivation and this subjugation in the end. It's Martin King Day, and I believe, Raj Patel, that the mistake that was made about the title of your work is that the value of nothing is a corollary to the price of everything, which means that people can name you a price but have no sense of value, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. The title is an Oscar Wilde. It comes from an Oscar Wilde quote that nowadays people know the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Exactly. And there's a morality issue there that's deep and abiding. I wanted to remind you and point out that Martin King, whose birthday we celebrate by bank holiday today, the banks have off, the rest of us don't, but is Martin King's last great efforts, and I've repeated myself several times now over the course of the last week, Dr. King's great efforts in the last year or two of his life, besides the Poor People's Campaign, was the idea that he was intractably opposed to two great ills of society. They are militarism, yes, and the other one, which is so important and so apropos to the subject of your work, materialism. And the materialism that infects people today, most especially young people, or we think young people, there's actually a lot of middle-aged men out there that are sucked into these things, you see. They're actually just teenagers in so many ways, I suppose. But the materialism is a kind of infection, a kind of a kind of thing that sets in, and like the gangrene that is affecting the severed limbs of our brothers and sisters and children, the children in Haiti, threatens their lives. This materialism threatens our lives because it is a kind of poison or infection. I wanted you to riff on that, but I'll take your riff off the air. Thanks so much. Thanks, Marianne.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, what a very articulate question. I think that's right. I mean, Dr. King did spend. People aren't perhaps so aware of this, but towards the end of his life, was a very strong opponent of not only the war in Vietnam, but also, as you say, materialism and of course poverty as well. I mean, towards the end of his life. He made the observation that the way to fight poverty in this country was to give poor people money, and his observations on that, are ones that are less well known. The Dr. King, who took very strong positions on redistribution and on the culture of materialism and consumption, is a Dr. King that isn't celebrated so much on occasions like this. But of course, we have a great tradition of plucking out the more radical kinds of elements of our heroes. And in the book, I talk about how Francis of Assisi, for example, the reason we see Francis of Assisi with animals today, we associate Saint Francis with animals, is because actually he was a proto-communist. He didn't think that the private property was a good thing, and he very much wanted to redistribute and wanted to transform the way that we lived to make us more Christ-like. That was the vision of Francis of Assisi, was to have a world in which we more fully became the kind of Jesus that one reads about in the Bible, and where property mattered less. But of course, we never hear about that kind of Francis of Assisi in the same way that we don't hear about the Dalai Lama. People associate the Dalai Lama for just sort of being in the arms of Richard Gere. The Dalai Lama himself has said, in terms of economic and social justice, I am a Marxist monk. And that's a very strange thing to hear, because particularly when someone has gone up against the awful power of the communist state in China, you would think that he would be utterly against Marxism. But of course, the awful governments of the Soviet Union, of communist China, of other governments that have concentrated power and used ideology in its name, that's very different from a view of the world where we need social justice, we need labor to be paid well. Those kinds of things we do need to start to remember, I think, particularly as this market crumbles around our ears.
Okay, and we're going to take a break here to tell you what's coming up. At 9 o'clock, it's the Olmo Variety Hour. Today's topics include Dietrich Mohammed of the Institute for Policy Study, and he'll be talking about Obama unemployment and the lack of a social safety net. There'll also be an interview with Robert McChesney on the future of newspapers, the Well-Read Red with Fran Mitchell on Haiti, Larry Bolden reviews a forthcoming novel by Portland writer Heidi Durow entitled Girl Who Fell from the Sky. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with locally produced headlines, interviews, and commentaries by Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's topic is mountaintop coal removal. Her guest, Judy Bonds, co-director for Coal River Mountain Watch, talks about the impact of this devastating practice on the lives, economy, and culture of her community. And at 11 o'clock and continuing all day until 6:30 p.m., we'll broadcast our annual Keep the Dream Alive, a tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., live from the Highland Christian Center in Northeast Portland. I'm Marianne Barasonic. You're listening to More Talk Radio. My guest is Raj Patel, and we're talking about his latest book, The Value of Nothing. And we're going to take another caller here. Good morning, Rabia.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Raj, for being on KBOO. It sounds like the book really speaks to the value of nothing, being that we have a false economy in highly developed countries that come at the expense of people living in less industrialized so that the values are, they're not really accurate. But my question is how, two questions. One, how can the system change with the kind of 24/7 stream of messages to continue to consume, and the message really kind of being the more you consume and the more isolated of a consuming unit you are, the more successful you are. And those are just the false messages, but they're everywhere and they're constant. So how can things change with those messages constantly streaming? And then the second part is how can we replace that current system with those messages, and what would we replace it with? And I'll just take that off the air.
Oh, great. So two very small questions then, but terrific questions, of course. And in fact, the second half of the book is filled with many ideas that actually already exist. And I think that this is the great news. I mean, although it does seem a fairly daunting task to sort of deprogram ourselves from consumer society, the good news is that there are tons of ways of doing it that already exist that have been thriving beneath the radar. And this is something that even the economics profession, which is famously not terribly interested in this kind of thing, has sort of observed by giving its latest Nobel Prize in economics in part to award Eleanor Ostrom, who's a professor at Indiana University. And she's done a lot of work on what's called the commons, which is ways of governing and distributing resources that aren't about the free markets, but are in fact more that involve much more community involvement. And this idea of community involvement, that we can get together and distribute resources in ways that are actually much more sustainable, those ways of governing our economy are indeed alive and well. And not only that, they're successful. They're more successful than the systems we have at the moment. There was a study that came out last year about forest communities, looking at how forest communities around the world manage the forests. And they found that the communities that had enough forest and that were able to have autonomy, in other words, to take care of themselves without the interference of the free market or of government, were able to not only have better levels of welfare of people who lived within those forest communities, but they were able to sequester more carbon. In other words, they were able to save more forest, which is good not only for them, but for everyone else as well.
Raj, let me jump in here for a minute, because when we hear about the commons, we often hear about the tragedy of the commons. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is why that's based on a myth.
Well, that's right. I mean, many people come to hear about the commons through this idea of the tragedy. And if listeners aren't familiar with it, very quickly, it's a story that was told in 1968 by a soil biologist called Garrett Hardin. And he wrote a think piece in the journal Science. And so there was no evidence for this. But it, as a think piece, it does capture people's imaginations. And the think piece is like this. Now, imagine us, all of us listening to this radio show right now, are a community around a forest. But nobody owns the forest. And so we, as selfish individuals, will go into the forest and we'll chop down trees and we'll take them home and we'll use them. And we'll keep going back into the forest and we'll keep chopping it down. And the forest will get smaller and smaller because nobody owns the forest. And we realize that we're destroying the forest. But the tragedy is that with eyes wide open, we will let our selfishness overrun the forest and it will be destroyed and there'll be nothing left. So that's the idea of the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy is that nobody owns it. And so because no one owns it, and because we are selfish and greedy, we will destroy it. Now, the trouble is that while it's a compelling thought experiment, has very little to do with the way commons have actually worked. If you look, if Garrett Hardin were, for example, a historian, then he would know that actually the commons in England, for example, where the term comes from, though there are commons in pretty much every major culture and major history, the commons worked very well. People were able to get together. They were able to negotiate rights and ways of managing that resource. And that's because the premise of Garrett Hardin's thought experiment is wrong. We aren't exclusively selfish individuals. Yeah, I mean, in economic modeling, it helps to have a selfish, greedy individual because then you can model that much more easily. But in fact, If you look at biology, for example, while our genes may be selfish, we have evolved not to be selfish. In order for us to survive, if we're talking about the survival of the fittest, fitness can, in our case, also mean generosity, altruism, cooperative ability. And that ability to cooperate and to restrain ourselves and to socialize ourselves into being something not that merely rapacious, well, that's the mark of being a primate. That's a mark of being human. And you see this kind of cooperative behavior all over the animal kingdom, but you certainly see it in humans.
Okay. And we're going to take another caller. Good morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. I'm going to come through in a second. How am I doing now?
Oh, much better.
Okay. I'm trying to learn how to address this exact issue. I'd like to try to answer the last question that was posed, and I'd like to try to use some of the concepts and even the language that were just used to do that. And if you can bear with me for a second, I'll start off with the question, how do we change things from what they are now and to something better, where we're all in this together instead of separately taking from the commons? So there I've incorporated the commons. I think that we can't just automatically stop human programming and expect something different to spontaneously erupt. I think that we have to start where we are with the human condition.
Right. Well, I can't help but wonder if we stopped having advertising beamed at us 24/7 from many different kinds of media, if our behavior wouldn't change.
I think that would immediately change things. The problem is, I don't think you want to turn off your billboards, do you?
Well, what do you think, Raj? Should we turn off the billboards?
No, not we, you. Do you want to turn off yours personally?
I don't have any billboards.
That is a big problem. And you're not talking to the people that own them or that are empowered to use them.
Well, actually, that's a really good question. And
okay,
it is one of the ones... Okay, go ahead.
I think we need to speak to the issue of personal empowerment. We can't do anything about them that own it currently. All we can do is speak to our own particular position in the world. But one of the things that we have done is we have not only accepted the exploitation of the commons, we as individuals in this country anyway, in the United States, we have allowed ourselves to be exploited as a part of the commons in our infrastructure. We have accepted the thing that a lot of us refer to loosely as corporate personhood. We have allowed ourselves to become a corporation, which is paying corporate taxes to maintain the infrastructure that is used to basically haul in cheap goods and exploit. It's part of the exploitation system and process. We are all paying privilege taxes to underwrite the corporate domination of our infrastructure. They are not only taking, using the commons for the corporate good by hauling cheap things from places that we can never get a true estimate of the cost of getting here, but they are taking it, they are imposing costs upon the people who actually should be more concerned about their personal stake in the commons. We all have a... And, am I making any sense here?
Well,
I need some feedback.
You're kind of making sense, but I guess you had said that you kind of had a solution, and if you could maybe in a very compact way give us what you have as a solution, and then we'll ask Raj what he thinks of that.
Okay, the highways are our commons upon which corporations base their exploitation. If it weren't for the infrastructure called highways, they couldn't do what they do. We, the people, have become brainwashed into thinking of ourselves as corporate entities who need to be taxed the privilege tax of using our commons, which is a matter of right. Historically, in our our social system, the commons have been a place where we have the right to use. But we are now thinking in terms of ourselves as being privileged entities to use our own infrastructure, thus underwriting the corporate cost of exploiting ourselves. If we would only stop paying that which has never been legal, even today in Oregon.
So you're
recently,
against the income tax?
No. The use of the infrastructure called the highways, the place where we all have a right to be, to come and go, to haul our wares to market, to pursue happiness. We are being systematically taught that it is a privilege for us to use our highways.
I guess I'm having a hard time understanding what you're getting at here.
Has anybody there ever bought a driver license? Isn't that a common idea in our culture? We are being convinced that we need a license.
What I'm hearing is it's tempting to think of things like highways and the public education system as a commons. Technically, in the language of economics, these are public goods. I see where you're going with the idea that we can take back our dollars from being exploited, and there's a lovely tradition certainly in the United States of things like the War Tax Resisters League, of people saying, well, actually, if the government is going to spend my money and corporations are going to get it at the end of the day, then I'm going to figure out what it is of my taxes that belongs to that goes to corporations, and I'm just not going to pay that.
There's a shift in consciousness that has to occur from what you're saying to what I'm trying to communicate. It's not my taxes that we are paying when we buy a driver license. We are being fraudulently compelled to relinquish our resources. It's not our taxes that we can resist with. We have to stop willingly being defrauded. We have to wake up and read our current law. Current Oregon law says the public has the right to use the highway, and willingly underwriting the corporate use of our commons, which is then a tool of exploitation. We need to regionalize our economies. We need to be
Well, caller, thank you very much. And I think, Raj, you actually have a example that might address this, the participatory budgeting in Porto Alegre in Brazil. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This idea of, well, how are we going to squeeze corporations out of our government, and how are we going to take things back? It does sound a little pie in the sky until you realize that it's something that's going on around the world today. One of the examples that works well, if we're thinking about, all right, what is it that we need to do to be able to reclaim our government from, say, corporations? One of the things that might be done is if we had much more control over the way that government spent their money. In Brazil, in a town called Porto Alegre, though of course this is more widespread, there's an example of this at work, and it's called participatory budgeting. And what it means is that citizens from across the city, from the very rich neighborhoods to the poorest favelas, to the poorest slums, meet together in local committees to figure out what they want the government to do and what the spending priorities should be and who should get the hospital first and which school should be built first and which playground. And then they meet together in citywide forums, sending their representatives to actually talk about and agree on a distribution of resources that everyone considers fair. And this process is actually, the caller before was talking about deprogramming. Well, the way that you deprogram yourself is not by sort of sitting around reading excellent books about the subject, but to actually get involved, to do stuff. They found that there's nothing that recruits like success. And the success of this initiative is one that has far outlived the party that put it, the political party that actually made it happen. And this does seem to be an example so successful it's being replicated around the world. So it is possible for us to take back the reins of government from from big business. But we need to start at a local level. But it is possible to do, and it is tremendously it's tremendously worthwhile.
Okay, and you're listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO in Portland. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest is Raj Patel. You used to work for the World Bank. Why did you leave?
Well, I have to say, I was brought on to the World Bank to do a project where we were going to critically investigate what was going on at the World Bank by looking at its reports on poverty. But in the end, I ended up working for the World Bank to produce a puff piece about how wonderful the World Bank was and how much the World Bank loved poor people. And it was—I mean, it was embarrassing and to be, to be railroaded in that way. And then in the end, I left. But I did learn something very important, which is that the people at the World Bank, by and large, are not sort of cartoonish villains who plot the demise of the Third World and who every day sit in black swivel chairs, stroking white cats, sort of cackling about how they're ruining Third World economies. So they tend in the main to be good people who believe that they're doing the right thing. But the trouble is that the way that they work, that they never have to suffer the consequences of what they do. There's no accountability. There's no living with the consequences of your actions. And that's something that I couldn't conscionably do. That's why I left. That's why I protested, because it is my government, it is my money that goes through these organizations. And because I am a citizen now of the United States, and I was a citizen then of the United Kingdom, two of the countries that give a great deal of money to the World Bank, and then through giving money do harm to people in developing countries, I couldn't in good conscience be a citizen of those countries and not take action against what I saw.
Okay, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. And again, my guest is Raj Patel, and his book is The Value of Nothing. So let's go over some other examples in your book where the market does the free market, so-called free market, does such a terrible job. Cell phones and coltan.
Well, that's right. I mean, the electronics that we use every day, that I'm using to speak to you, that I own, I'm as much a part of as everyone else, is bought at a very high price. There's a mineral that ends up going in high performance capacitors that are particularly used in cell phones, but they're used in other things as well. And this mineral called coltan, well, 75% of the world's resources of it are found in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And as we're learning, the trade in coltan fuels epidemic levels of violence, of rape, of degradation, and of suffering in the Congo. There's been a campaign in the United Kingdom called "No Blood on My Cell Phone," which is basically like the blood diamond idea, which people may be more familiar with. That actually. You don't need to be wearing diamonds to be caught up in some fairly nasty politics and gun trading and all the rest of it in Africa. And again, this is not something that cell phone companies or any other electronics companies, come to mention it, would like you to know about.
I thought it was a particularly really good example because, on the one hand, we have all this advertising telling us to get the latest and the newest, and we have all kinds of incentives to keep turning over to get new cell phones every year or every 2 years. And on the other hand, having these resources has not brought the people who live where the coltan is anything but complete misery. And it seems like that shouldn't at least having the resources that are being so valued everywhere else, it's not bringing them prosperity.
No, that's right. And in part, that's because attempts to set up democratic government in the Congo have always been stymied. It's one thing to have resources and a way of governing them and a way of perhaps even profiting from them. But any attempts to set up government in the Congo have been consistently beaten down. And one hates to point the finger, but again, the U.S. government was responsible for the murder of a democratically elected President Lumumba in the Congo, and his replacement with a dictator, Mobutu, and the ongoing interference in order to for us in rich countries to access resources that are valuable in poor countries has often meant that we have been complicit not only in the misery of these communities, but also in setting up the infrastructure through which they might be exploited, despite their best efforts to create democratically accountable governments that they could use to protect those resources and to share them with the world on terms that they choose.
Raj, are you saying that the U.S. isn't spreading democracy all over the world?
One hates to admit it, but since, as I say, I'm now American, I can say fairly confidently that whenever my government it says it's promoting democracy, there's usually an ulterior motive behind it. There are plenty of places that could do with democracy, including the United States. I think the place to start spreading democracy would be right here, and that's what I'm arguing in the book.
Okay, and I think we have another caller. We'll get to them in a second. Yes, it would be nice if we had real democracy here in the United States. Okay, good morning, caller.
Well, good morning. I have a question for him. He had a couple of comments on the communist government in China, and I just left a project over there for the last 2 years. And what I'd like to suggest is that what's happening in China is actually positive relative to how the United States deals with foreign countries, just like you were talking about the Clinton administration and the Reagan administration in Haiti. By us staying out of China and allowing the Chinese government to go ahead and develop their country, that you have a chance to have the people leave the farms and go into kind of like what we ran into back in the early 90s or 1900s, the turn of the century. You have people that are now coming out of the farms and are being able to live, a reasonable life with washers and dryers and heaters in their apartments and that sort of thing. And you look forward then, once you realize this, you look forward to them going to a democracy over the next, generation. The people themselves will drive it, and it won't have to be done, by our government.
So I think that's a tremendously important point. And of course, it's important to look at the foundation of Chinese democracy, which is, of course, land reform. It's all well and good to have a particular political party in power way out in Beijing, but very far removed from the rest of the country. But the one thing that they were very certain to do around the country was to redistribute land so that they broke the back of the aristocracy that was ruling over them in rural areas. So that there was a level playing field from which democracy, from which the economy might develop. Now, of course, you're right this was done despite the wishes of rich countries in Europe and North America. But you're also, it's also important to notice the ambiguities of what's going on in China. There is suppression of human rights. And in fact, this year, there have been over, I believe the figure is 300,000, I'll have to check, 300,000 what are called mass incidents. In other words, protests of workers that involve hundreds, if not thousands, of workers protesting against the unfairness of their economy. Now, this is interesting because, it might be possible to interpret the rise of these immense worker protests in China as the bubblings up of Chinese democracy. I'm not sure, I certainly think that China has now become, in many ways, an imperial power, just like the United States and Britain and all these other powers have been doing. And if you look at the way China behaves in Africa, there's a lot.
No. You're way off base. The Chinese, you could go back to our last president, when we got into our financial crisis. He goes back to the Chinese sitting on their $2 trillion U.S. dollars, or our $2 trillion U.S. dollars, and saying, hey, help me with my banks. And the Chinese said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. They put that money back into their own economy, and went in with more overall capital projects to keep their people going, because they've got 25% of the workforce working on construction. They want to make sure that all those people work, because that money trickles down. They understand what economics is really about, where our legislature, our Congress people have no idea how economics works. All they want to do is get more money coming in from the pharmacies, and from the healthcare people and all that kind of stuff. That, not the Chinese government, okay? They're trying to create jobs for their people, real jobs.
No, I know that. I was in Malawi a month ago where...
No, we're talking about China. And you go back and you look at the specifics of this and how the local cities and the villages are set up. I mean, a village is 2 million people over there, and they've got 7 or 8 mayors. Those mayors are shaking in their boots when you have people that go out there and stand in front of City Hall. Okay, now tomorrow they might be in jail, but in the first day, if they don't squelch that or satisfy the requirements of the people that are staying at the front gates, those mayors lose their job. And sometimes they just, you know, disappear mysteriously. So the mayors are very much in tune.
I mean, if you do a bad job as a public official, it is right that you not hold office. But disappearing mysteriously and being executed doesn't seem to be terribly good.
It's a hell of a lot better than what we did in Vietnam, where we're over there.
I'm not making any apologies. I mean, I'm taking very much a sort of dim view of both large governments. And here's why. The reason I brought up Malawi was because China is in Africa in a very big way. Because it has done a very bad job of managing its water resources, particularly in northern China. And it's looking for food. It's looking for places to be able to start importing food from. And in other words, it's part of a scramble for Africa, just like Europe and North America was a century ago. And you're seeing the ways that China is exacerbating tensions in Africa by buying up land, buying up water resources that are tremendously unsustainable. So I want to take a very critical view of big government wherever it is. But I do want to celebrate the struggles of people who are fighting for genuine democracy, whether they're in China or in Africa.
So it sounds like what's happening is the Chinese government may be bettering the lives for some of the Chinese, but it's at the cost of the quality of life for the people in Africa.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you're looking at certainly what are called land grabs, the process whereby big governments and big corporations are going in, particularly into Africa, but also other parts of the world. China's big in Pakistan at the moment. By buying up land in order to secure food for the people back home,
right.
The government is exacerbating tensions that already exist in the countries where it's operating.
Okay, and we're going to try to take one more caller. No, we don't have another caller. They gave up.
Oh.
Okay. Well, that idea of the democracy developing in China, I was shocked to hear that number, 300,000 protests?
Right. I mean, the figure for 2009, in fact, I recently posted it on my website, and I'm just blanking on the precise number. But if people want to know more, they can go to rajpatel.org and look that up.
Okay, and we should mention, too, that if people want to talk to you some more, you'll be at Powell's Bookstore tomorrow night.
The legendary Powell's Bookstore, that's right.
Yes, this will be the one on Burnside tomorrow night at 7:30.
That's right. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, I think Portland is going to be a really good crowd for you here.
Somehow I think so.
And you've been listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest has been Raj Patel. Raj, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marianne. It's been a pleasure.
You lie in D.C. Where a war can be won. You want me to believe. But I see through your eyes. And I see through. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
It's your KBOO Community Calendar Girl here for Monday, January 18th, 2010. This day, in the spirit of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we carry out community service. PSU and Concordia University's Day On, Not Day Off rally and service with Hands on Greater Portland has happily reached capacity, but you can still call your favorite organization and offer to help. You can also prepare a vegan meal or help serve the communal meal with Food Not Bombs at 5:30 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park on Southeast 17th and Taylor. For the latest updates on the winter hotline for assistance in shelter, food, and clothing, dial 211. Most agencies are still looking for volunteers. Until 10:30 a.m., the Scanner Foundation holds its 24th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast at the Oregon Convention Center at 777 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard.
Portland State University holds its annual Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration event at 7 p.m. this evening, featuring the distinguished keynote speaker, Public Broadcasting's anchorwoman, Daljit Dhaliwal. Highlighting Dr. King's international pedigree, this lecture will also chronicle his impact on people and nations beyond the U.S. Admission is free to students with a valid ID. For tickets for the general public, call 503-725-3307. The Tidal Wave Used Bookstore month-long sale commemorates Martin Luther King Day with 55% off all African-American books all day tomorrow, Tuesday the 19th. The bookstore and Multnomah County Libraries are closed for the holiday today.